wonder who's watching me now.
So we're going to call this the Vault 7 Hastings Postmortem, because we all know cyber hacking of cars is in the little details of the latest WikiLeaks, God bless them, Goddess bless them, release. Excuse me while I hit the little pause on my recording to cruise through the Scott Bennett Truth Unite, they're going to have this little debate where he lays out what the boogeyman in the closet really is. Everybody's undies in a bind about something here, and I just don't want to subject you to the... I'll save that for later, but... Audacity, where did I leave you? Okay, here we go. Okay. So, I gotta read this. The debate. Wiretapping President Trump. The secret cover-up behind the spying. Political tensions have been rising in U.S. since Trump took office, blah, blah, blah. On March 6, 2017, Press TV televised a debate about the Trump Tower wiretapping scandal. This discussion analyzed the theory, evidence, and ultimate implications of the President Trump being spied on and betrayed by the Obama administration's deep state intelligence community agents and their agenda of deconstructing the Trump administration. One wiretap, one scandal, one execution at a time. Of course, what the Obama deep state minions didn't count on, which will destroy them, was the alternative media and the larger, more treasonous and mostly offensive issues and witnesses that are now conveniently also being exposed as a result of this wiretapping Pandora's box. Most significant of these secret cover-ups was the terrorist finance operation managed by President Obama's State Department, Hillary Clinton, the Clinton Foundation, Swiss Bank, Union Bank of Switzerland, and HSBC. Of course, we remember Loretta Lynch's little, they're just going to get this slap on the wrist for the cartel money. Anyway, back to, and their client states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and Israel. Scott Bennett reveals how these issues were the reason that Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, General Michael Flynn, and Senator Jeff Sessions were targeted for propaganda attacks in an attempt to hide this terrorist finance issue, since they all had received Scott Bennett's report, Shell Game, and Hillary Clinton, Obama, and the deep state knew it. Luckily, WikiLeaks knew it too, for soon after this Press TV program, WikiLeaks responded by releasing Vault 7, unlawful CIA surveillance programs, and the genesis of the false Russian Trump conspiracy myth. Of course, this mouse report is titled Vault 7 Hastings Postmortem Car Hacking. Of course, that Mercedes, one of the safest cars, brand new, speeding down top speed and blowing up with thermite, the engine landing a football field away. Some things aren't funny. It must be said, WikiLeaks has done more to awaken and empower Americans than any other organization in history, including the church. Since the early days of 2012, WikiLeaks has provided Swiss Bank whistleblower Brad Bergenfeld and Army officer Booz Allen Hamilton contractor Scott Bennett with cables from the State Department indicating Hillary Clinton's various acts of treason and collusion with terrorist mercenaries in Libya. For this alone, Julian Assange deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. This report is unclassified and may be reviewed at ShellGameWhistleblower.com. Warning, this material may result in American Revolution or Renaissance, depending on you, Scott Bennett, U.S. Army Psychological Operations, and Deep and State Department Counterterrorism Analyst, retired. And I'll spare you that Christian blather that follows.
Oh, no.
I warned you, this has got some endless horror and bad news and mind fork, but we've got some antidotes there. Well, we'll spring Jethro Tull on them for that. Now, I don't see the little triangle going to a pause, so my Saving Mina bridge is frozen.
Ah,
well, this is a job for the pause button.
Just when U.S. President Donald Trump is furious about the negative impact of the flap over Attorney General Jeff Sessions' meetings with the Russian ambassador to the U.S., he tweeted that President Barack Obama had ordered Trump Tower to be wiretapped, a charge for which Trump provided no evidence. This is while the FBI has rejected that claim as being false. In this edition of the debate, we'll discuss if there's any truth to that and whether Trump's administration is in disarray and whether the deep state is after ultimately dismantling Trump. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, columnist, political scientist, and radio host Wilmer Leon joins us from Washington. And we have political analyst and former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett, who joins us from San Francisco. Gentlemen, welcome. Scott Bennett, I will start with you and ask you a straight question. Is there any truth to Trump's wiretap accusations against the Obama administration?
Absolutely, 100%. It's absolutely truth, and I know it for a fact because we communicated this report to his lawyer, Michael Cohen, and immediately Cohen was targeted. Now, Trump tried to spin that by saying they got the wrong Michael Cohen, but they really didn't. They targeted Michael Cohen, his attorney, because we had communicated that Hillary Clinton, the Clinton Foundation, Saudi Arabia, Qatar were engaged in terrorist financing in Libya, in Syria. Turkey was engaged. Boats full of weapons were coming across from Turkey to get into Libya. Saudi mercenaries, Qatari mercenaries were all flooding Libya. The Libyan tribes have been fighting against these mercenaries and have been giving us information and intelligence that we've been sending up to the Trump campaign. And that's why, really, a lot of the Trump Tower was targeted. Now, they've used a semantic term of wiretapping to try and say, well, technically it wasn't a wiretapping. But what President Trump essentially has said is they've been listening to me. They've been targeting my people. They've been listening to the phone calls. And he will prove that with a forensic analysis of all of the NSA, CIA, NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, National Security Agency, Central Intelligence Agency, all of the technology that he's used in those listening and mapping. That will all come out because Trump can declassify every single thing that has been done to him, and his attorney general can prosecute Dianne Feinstein, Chuck Schumer, various members, both Republican and Democrat, for aiding and abetting the enemy because they knew about this material in 2012 and beyond. So it's just coming out. This is the Democrat Party and the establishment in free fall, desperate to avoid prosecution. Make no mistake, they know all of this stuff is coming out, and they are running for the hills in a desperate attempt to start saving their lives. Next, you're going to see them cannibalizing each other, saying, well, I'll make a deal. I'll report on Feinstein if you don't prosecute me, says Senator Bill Nelson of Florida.
A whole bunch of revelations there, Wilmer Leon. What's your reaction?
That's a bunch of gibberish. And he hasn't provided any sustainable
facts. I was there. You weren't. I wore the uniform. I had a top secret clearance.
Such a senseless allegation. The President of the United States cannot lawfully issue wiretaps. He just can't do it. And so what
sun streaking cold, an old man wandering lonely, taking time the ugly way.
Let's put it this way.
There couldn't bat as it bends to pick. And it goes down to the bark and warms his feet.
Mm-hmm.
sets with deep sea diver sounds, and the flowers bloom like manners in the spring. Sun streaking cold, an old man wandering lonely, taking time the only way he knows. Leg hurting bad as he bends to pick a target, he goes down to the bog and warms his feet. Ooh, 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 ooh. Feeling alone, the armies of the road, salvation alone, that cup of tea. Aqualung, my friend, don't you start away uneasy. You poor old sod, you see.
DJ, I don't know what happened, but let's go back to this.
Well, I would simply say, Your Honor, they've attempted to listen into the President of the United States three times. The first two times were shot down. So in the third time, they introduced a request not using President Trump's name, simply identifying foreign activities in Trump Tower.
And I got to say, this guy's a Trump apologist, and of course DJ Mouse is not, but he can correctly critique the Dixiecratic plantation foreman that blah, 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 blah.
And the real story is that members of the House and the Senate were in collusion with Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation and Barack Obama and the law firm Covington & Burling and Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer to hide this report, which was Shell Game, which everyone can see at shellgamewhistleblower.com. And it is from a United States military officer that had a top secret clearance, that worked at U.S. Central Command, worked at the State Department, worked at U.S. Special Operations Command, and Booz Allen Hamilton, the same firm that employed Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden is connected to this report. Brad Birkenfeld, the Swiss banker, is connected to this report. This report was given to Michael Cohen, President Trump's attorney. This report was given to Sean Spicer, President Trump's press secretary, and his staff. And it is continuing to reveal the illegal activities that were conducted in Libya and Syria and a lot of the Middle East policy under Obama.
by Edward Snowden until the very last second. Now, Glenn Greenwald, the billionaire journalist, is also getting this information and not talking about the assassination campaign because it doesn't sell. When Annie Machen told The Guardian, his employer, that, you know, your MI6 is creating these shithook medieval assassins that go after my stunt double Gaddafi, they said, so what? And then she had to say, but they're also looking into your bathroom, seeing your private parts, you know, do you want that? And then that's why the surveillance thing becomes the issue, not the assassination contra war. Okay.
Which also includes bringing in people from Libya under false passports into the United States. All of that has been documented and sent up. That is one of the big reasons that there's such a desperate attempt to listen in and try and get a hold of this and manage this.
And he is so dead on in this debate that I got to save him while I hit the little pause button on the recording and go into this business.
Speakers, as patriots, what we need to do to engage these media establishments and political people around the world.
Okay,
so that we are guiding our country in the way that we know it needs to go, and that we are no longer allowing it to come off the rails and go into all sorts of destructive war situations.
Those seven countries are the seven countries on the except they're subbing Lebanon for Iraq because, you know, we already took them into pieces, and now we got our little proxies in power. And how are you going to keep them in power if you don't let them come back and hide when people are on to their game? And so, of course, Iraq gets substituted, and Yemen is at, or no, Yemen was on the original, I think. Anyway, you know Wesley Clark, right after the Pentagon defense holiday for drone strikes, the two drone strikes and triple demolitions in WTC. Back to endless bad news and horror. Senator Dick Black, back from trip to Syria.
Absolute chaos. So I'm so honored and pleased to have Senator Black with us for as long as he can spend, and we're going to be getting into a variety of subjects, including the Clinton Foundation and terrorist financing and what we know about terrorist financing going through Hillary Clinton and the Department of Justice and the Barack Obama team and all of that shenanigans that we've disclosed in Shell Game and the Saudi Arabians and the Qataris, as well as the Syrian war that we're dealing with. Senator Black has gone over to Syria and has spent time there and has enormous experience and a wealth of knowledge. And where we go from here, when so many troubles in our own country seem to be arising, possibly as a distraction away from some of these Middle Eastern affairs.
But I'm going to go back to queue up my Jesus Save Me from Aqualung, because when he starts talking about our Christian heritage, you know, the unsung Western hero killed the Indians for free, then he made his name in Hollywood to set the white man free. Yeah, that
I'm little girls with bad intent. Try and catch some sun. Saw at least 100 schoolgirls sobbing into handkerchiefs as one. I don't believe they knew I was a schoolboy.
With a very strange reality, as people that were sent over there to, quote, fight a war, and yet we were saddled with something called rules of engagement, and there was a political confusion there. And yet the reality is many of us came back and understood that it didn't matter that there was confusion. What
courageous Syrian army people who have fought against.
Go ahead, Senator.
Yes, I'll tell you what happened. Just during this last week, you know, of course, we had this peace agreement that had been arrived at. We were going to have a ceasefire. We were going to do various things. After the agreement was signed by Russia, the United States, There is an outpost that has been under siege. It's held by the Syrian army. It's at Deir al-Zor. This has been a static siege for the last couple of years. Tremendously courageous Syrian army people who have fought against ISIS. And ISIS has launched repeated attacks. They've been driven off again and again. Apparently, the United States has decided, for whatever strategic reasons, that they want to eliminate Deir al-Zor. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but I think the circumstances are very suspicious. You have two sides. It's the Syrian army and it's ISIS. Very clear cut. The lines are static. They have not been moving. And the United States, Britain, Denmark, and Australia, I believe, launched an hour-long airstrike, and it was not targeted against ISIS. They have never before launched an airstrike in the Deir al-Zor area. They targeted the defenses at Deir al-Zor, and they did a brutal attack against the Syrian army, knowing precisely where they were, using GPS-directed munitions, and they murdered 82 Syrian soldiers. There are probably another 100 that are very critically wounded with loss of limbs and things of that sort. And it was done apparently in coordination with ISIS, because as soon as the bombing lifted, ISIS immediately moved in to the attack. Nobody has ever worried about the fact that the city of Deir al-Zor, which is a significant city, has been under siege. Nobody has demanded that the UN or anybody else go in there and resupply them and provide food and medical assistance. Doesn't matter. Unless it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda, we don't care
right.
about sieges. We don't care. We want, when there's a siege, we want to make sure that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are resupplied, and that's the only reason for these so-called UN relief columns or whatever. But anyway, I wrote a letter to Ambassador Bashar al-Assad, who is the Syrian ambassador to the United States, and I told him that I wanted to express my sincere regrets. I said that I can't say whether this was a deliberate attack, but the lines have been static for years. The aircraft were guided by GPS targeting devices. And then I went on and I said, you know, normally I would automatically dismiss this as just an accidental attack. However, over the almost six years that I've watched this war evolve, a couple of things have come out as glaring examples of the United States' support for ISIS. And the first one is the fact that ISIS ran a huge fleet of oil tankers. There were 2,000 oil tankers. They were traveling with plundered oil from Syria into Turkey unmolested. There was never any interference with them, and they would be in columns miles long. And it wasn't until the Russians went in with a modest expeditionary force, and they said, okay, we're going to cut that lifeline. They went in. They destroyed 500 oil tankers within the span of 2 days. The United States are kind of peculiar. I mean, it's otherworldly the way that we function.
Yeah.
The day after the big bombing and destruction of the oil tankers, the U.S. tried to claim credit for it. And then when that didn't fly, we said, well, okay, we didn't do it, but the Russians didn't destroy nearly as many as they claimed that they had. Well, both were lies. The Russians were very effective, and I was told by the head of Syrian military intelligence while I was over there that the number of destroyed ISIS tankers is now up to 1,500. The proof is in the fact that ISIS had to cut all of its salaries for all of its military and civilian personnel in half. That's what Russia was able to do by decisively interdicting the oil pipeline. So I said, this is one thing that makes me hesitate to say that this was just accidental. The other thing, when I was in Syria back in April, I went out to Deir al-Zor, or rather, I went out to Palmyra.
Mm, yeah.
Palmyra was essentially the high water mark of ISIS.
Yes.
They had launched a vast attack on this city. It is a tremendous defensive position, so you don't take Palmyra without an enormous force. So I later traveled from Palmyra, which they had just ravaged. They had raped and pillaged and murdered, and they had destroyed antiquity. This was the United Nations UNESCO World Heritage Site. It belonged not only to Syria, but really to all of the civilized world.
Yes.
And they destroyed, they ravaged the place. And so I went with a convoy. We probably, I don't know whether we had half a dozen or a dozen vehicles, but we had three truck-mounted cannon. We had a MiG jet flying on our right flank. We had four attack helicopters on our left flank. And we went out into Indian country.
Yeah.
And so I got a very good look at the terrain that ISIS had traveled over and where they still were when I went out there, because I
have to remind everybody he used the term Indian country, so that is the term that's the Saldu used for Iraq. Saldu is the Yahi word for their killers.
I tried to stop at one place. I said, you know, I want to get a photo of this. And everybody in the bulletproof vehicle with me said, no, sir, we don't think that's a good idea. And I've been around long enough to know, even though I was in charge of the convoy, when people give you good advice, you take it. I said, okay. And we forged on. But here's the thing. The U.S. coalition was 67 nations and a huge arsenal of jet aircraft and weapons and so forth. Clearly saw this vast army moving. Now, they had to move from anywhere in ISIS-controlled territory. They had to travel 100 miles across open desert. Now, this is not sand dune desert. This is rocky desert, like you find in the American Southwest. And so it's not a place with dust storms that conceal things. They had to be in the wide open for 100 miles with this vast army of tanks and artillery pieces and trucks. And the coalition, knowing that they were there, deliberately elected to stand down, just as it did in Benghazi, and to let them move on and to seize Palmyra. Now, why? Because the geography of Syria is such that from ISIS to Palmyra is halfway to Damascus. And I am convinced that the coalition was quite willing to see ISIS impose its grim reign of terror on all of the Syrian people. And I just thank God for those who intervened to prevent that fate, including the Syrian military. I did a real review of the troops who were assembled on the ridge line, the final ridge line that they had seized when they took it. And I told the generals, I said, I can't believe these guys attacked up these barren hills where there is not a bit of cover or concealment. You're in the wide open. And ISIS occupied a huge castle at the top where they had complete concealment, and they came up those hills from three directions, and the deputy commanding general of the Syrian forces died at the foot of the castle leading those troops. And I gotta tell you, you know, I have enormous respect for the U.S. military. All of us have served in it. We know the great troops, but with the purge of the generals that had taken place under President Obama, I wonder any of those generals, knowing that they were going to almost certain death, would personally lead that attack up that ridge line, facing the guns up above them, shooting down from the parapets of a great fortress, and give their lives. And it shows the tremendous level of patriotism and unity among the Syrian people that is totally obscured by the U.S. media.
Yeah.
So, when I saw that we had attacked Deir al-Zor and just brutally slaughtered all of these innocent Syrian soldiers, I did not have confidence that this was not a deliberate employment of force in order to hand over Deir al-Zor to ISIS. We played games with ISIS. We bomb them one place, in the other place, Turkey says, okay, we want you to withdraw, and they withdraw. Turkey moves in with another terrorist army, which they've invaded across the border with, and I call it ISIS 2.0.
Yeah.
They're no different. They're the same guys. Right. They didn't fight with ISIS. They fought with the Kurdish troops that had been our allies.
Yeah.
I tell you, the United States has become the most unreliable ally on the face of the planet.
Yeah.
We said, you know, the Kurds are our best and our most reliable ally. We put American troops embedded with them, and then when the Turks put pressure on us and perhaps threatened to blackmail some people by releasing information about our involvement in some of the war crimes over there, the next thing, we took those embedded troops from our Kurdish allies, and we put them with the Turks.
Yeah.
And help them, and they're required to lead a terrorist army in attacking our Kurdish allies.
Yeah.
It's just, it's vile, and it's such an abuse.
Yes.
Of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines who are sworn to defend their country. They got to follow orders, and they're forced to do things that are immoral.
Yeah. Yeah, it's staggering, and your eloquent presentation of it is powerful in the historicity and the strategic analysis. It's unforgivable, of course, from a tactical point of view, as you know better than anyone. Coming from an old school, an old guard of military character, you saw precisely where the nexus was, the choke point that we could have really killed off this whole invasion of the enemy, and we didn't do it because. And the facts are really presenting themselves. The facts are unfolding like a puzzle, and it's fascinating how God sort of is bringing all this together. And my faith is just more and more confirmed. And Michael Jay and I laugh, and at the same time we're outraged by the tragic comedy of this whole thing. But when you look at the WikiLeaks cables and the Guccifer leaks, and you see Clinton Foundation documents and email accounts, and by their own fruits, by their own words, they're hanging themselves like Haman on his own hangman's noose. And the entire Obama administration, Clinton administration, and all of their generals, all of these people that they've appointed in our places, they've kicked all the good ones and the best ones that were serving to fight the Muslim Brotherhood. That's what we were doing when I was in the military, and we were targeting the Muslim Brotherhood. And when Obama came in, all of us were either fired, put in jail, decommissioned, or some worse. And that whole shift in the sea ushered in what we've seen now in the fall of Libya and now the fall of Syria, or the attempt to fall of Syria. I don't think Russia's going to allow it to happen. I think it's miraculous how they stepped in and have done so well. And we've tragically thrown what could have been a very great friendship, and I wanted to touch on that too, because I had a meeting with Peter LaBelle today, and I have a great deal of respect for Peter LaBelle of RT Crosstalk, and he is an American, he's living over there, but he shares this quizzical bewilderment of how in the world can Americans be so angry and upset and animated against Russia and Russian culture and Vladimir Putin. And I shared with him your great work and your statement and the promise that there are more and more like you and myself that love Russia, like their culture, have experience with them, do not have problems to the degree that we would with Wahhabi, Salafist, boy raping, beheading, women burning nut jobs, but how it's so important to have men like you interface and present the face and the voice of true American political leadership. So I wanted to just kind of open that up to let you talk about what you think we need to be doing in regards to our relationship with Russia. Let's start with Russia, because they really are the big kid on the block that's holding Syria together. God forbid they let go and the whole thing falls apart.
Sure.
Well, I skipped a bunch of stuff where he was talking about their common Christian heritage, and then there's some more stuff where they're talking about Russia's Christian blah blah blah. Of course, racism goes hand in hand. A century ago, Lermontov was writing, "The wicked Chechen sharpens his kinzel, but fear not, your father's a battle-hardened warrior." So they fired musket balls through 8 natives here in Turtle Island, but those Russian promeshleniki were all wiped out. It was the commoner Baranov, who was the governor, who married native that survived as New Archangel and Sitka. Okay, so you said God. That was enough for this.
The graven image, you know,
with his plastic crucifix. He's got him fixed. Confuses me as to who and where and why, as to how he gets his kicks. He gets his kicks. Confessing to the endless sin, the endless whining sounds. You'll be praying till next Thursday to all the gods that you can count.
If this is Vault 7 Hastings post-mortem, then we got to get to this crashes of convenience, Vault 7 problem reaction solution, New World next week. And this is CorbettReport.com, Media Monarchy.
Welcome back to New World next week. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And I'm James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com. 3D printing houses in one day. We've got that story plus boycotting Coke. But first, Vault 7, as we all now know, was the WikiLeaks release of the so-called largest ever publication of CIA hacking tools. Now, as everybody's diving into all of this stuff, there's going to be probably some pretty amazing revelations. There's also going to be lots of wild geese chases and red herrings and other funny animal sayings that mean distraction. But there's also lots of confirmation to stories we've discussed over the previous 300 episodes of New World Next Week, like this one. CIA can hack cars to carry out undetectable assassinations, just like Michael Hastings. And we grab an article from our friend Claire Burnish, who notes award-winning journalist Michael Hastings garnered international acclaim for coverage of the Iraq War and had established a comfortable career with BuzzFeed, GQ, and Rolling Stone when his life abruptly ended in a fiery one-car crash under suspicious circumstances. A prominent national security official claimed it was consistent with a cyber car attack. That was Richard A. Clarke talking to the Huffington Post. Now, with WikiLeaks' release of this voluminous cache of CIA documents known as Vault 7, it seems like Clark is right yet again. So Hastings, of course, as we've noted here on these shows, and James more extensively in your work, Hastings rose to prominence with the reporting of the Iraq War for Newsweek, but it was his big old expose for Rolling Stone in 2010, The Runaway General, where he wrote about General Stanley McChrystal, commander of NATO's International Assistance Security Force in the Afghanistan War, that even earned Hastings the George Polk Award, ultimately cost General McChrystal his career, and perhaps cost Hastings his life. Hastings' last article, I think it's important to note, for BuzzFeed was titled Why Democrats Love to Spy on Americans. Now, there's a movie coming out on Netflix with Brad Pitt as the Stanley McChrystal character, because I know that's exactly the first person you would think of to cast as a Stanley McChrystal character. So obviously, taking a little bit of Hollywood liberties. It's called War Machine, and it's coming out on Netflix on May 26th. And hopefully, as we get to that release date, we'll have some more interesting information related to that. But it's actually based on the nonfiction book The Operators by Michael Hastings. James, I know you've talked about this a lot, and there are probably lots of other areas that we could and will talk about with regards to Vault 7. So, again, Michael Hastings.
Yes, and so just to follow up on all of that, of course, people should check out my Crashes of Convenience episode on Michael Hastings if they haven't done so, which laid it all out years ago, talking exactly about this and about how, hey, you know, they really can hack into cars and they can do things like this.
And well, if you gave us $5 for a two-hour-a-week show, you could switch to Crashes of Convenience, Michael Hastings. Just like DJ Malkin.
You're listening to the Corbett Report. CorbettReport.com.
Episode 274, because he doesn't say that.
The Los Angeles coroner's office today confirmed that journalist Michael Hastings died Tuesday in a horrible car crash. His body was removed from the burned wreckage of his Mercedes, but it wasn't until today that he was identified. The 33-year-old Hastings was a reporter for Rolling Stone magazine when he wrote a profile about Army General Stanley McChrystal, which ultimately led to his resignation. The cause of the crash is under investigation, but it is believed that Hastings was driving at a high rate of speed. Toxicology tests on Hastings are expected back in about 8 weeks.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of the Corbett Report. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the sunny climes of Western Japan, here on this 5th day of July, 2013. Welcome to episode 274 of the Corbett Report podcast, Crashes of Convenience, Michael Hastings. What we've just been watching is footage of the evening broadcast of KTVU, the Fox News affiliate in Oakland, California, from the evening of June 20th, 2013, reporting on the car crash that took the life of Michael Hastings on the morning of June 18th, 2013. And just like that, one of the most dangerous mainstream reporters in America was dead. Before we look into the very mysterious circumstances surrounding that very mysterious car crash, however, perhaps we should reflect for a moment on that title, one of the most dangerous mainstream reporters in America. What does that really mean? Well, certainly, Michael Hastings came with a journalistic pedigree that most of the corporate prostitute mainstream journalists would, if you forgive the very unfortunate turn of phrase, die for. After having graduated with a degree in journalism from NYU back in 2002, Michael Hastings almost immediately took up a post with Newsweek, eventually becoming an embedded reporter in Iraq and spending much of the preceding several years there, which he then parlayed into experiences for several books, including a bestseller, a New York Times bestseller, The Operators. But it is perhaps for a Rolling Stone article that he penned back in 2010 that he will be best known. In that article, The Runaway General, Hastings reported on some of the very incendiary statements of General Stanley McChrystal, statements that eventually got McChrystal dismissed.
The president, having accepted McChrystal's forced resignation because of the general's scornful remarks about the commander-in-chief and other administration officials in the now infamous Rolling Stone magazine interview, at a Rose Garden news event, the president saying General McChrystal's explosive comments and those of his top aides left the general unfit to lead.
Today I accepted General Stanley McChrystal's resignation as commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. I did so with considerable regret, but also with certainty that it is the right thing for our mission in Afghanistan, for our military, and for our country. War is bigger than any one man or woman, whether a private or a president. And as difficult as it is to lose General McChrystal, I believe that it is the right decision for our national security. The conduct represented in the recently published article does not meet the standard that should be set by a commanding general.
Now, any time a relatively mainstream reporter can actually get top brass Pentagon officials dismissed for their reporting, I think it definitely serves our interest to take a look into what they are actually reporting on. But it can still happen that sometimes these are the types of moves that happen behind the scenes with insiders and people who play in the Beltway politics baseball game, that they can come across these types of stories, and sometimes some of the pieces get shuffled around. Sometimes these stories aren't really that significant. But there is every indication that Michael Hastings was the real deal, and he really was making some big-time enemies in Washington before his all-too-untimely death at the age of 33. And for some more insight on that, rather than me simply expounding on Michael Hastings, his viewpoints, and his journalistic career, why don't we leave that up for him to explain himself, as he did just over a year ago in an interview that was recorded by Cenk Uygur of the Young Turks.
The Newsweek that I knew has been totally decimated and destroyed after it was sold for $1 a couple of years ago. But when I was at Newsweek, when I started it, there were 26 foreign correspondents. They now have two.
Wow! See, that's a really interesting fact. I didn't know that.
So I coming up in the media, I've kind of witnessed this kind of, you know, industry-wide change from a very kind of ground level. You
say. What years were you at Newsweek?
2002 to 2008, and then in 08 I covered the presidential election for Newsweek. Covered Hillary, Secretary Clinton, who was in Senator Clinton, and then dropped that, and then quit Newsweek after she left because I kind of got sick of Newsweek.
Oh, that's interesting. You were covering Senator Clinton at the time.
At the time when she was running.
When she was running. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. And so, what is that when you went over to Rolling Stone?
Then I started going to Afghanistan, and I'd go for Afghanistan, Iraq for GQ. For about a year and a half, and then started writing for Rolling Stone. Mm-hmm. I find this interesting. Newsweek, I found, was too mainstream, and I couldn't actually write what I really wanted to say. Uh-huh. And I kind of got sick of it. I was like, I don't give a f***. Like, I'm quitting this great job I have, where I'm getting all these benefits and going out on my own. And then started doing my own thing, was kind of in the wilderness, and then started writing for Rolling Stone.
Once again, you've said something really interesting. So how did that process work? So you would write something, and what your editor would say what?
It's not even what the editor says. It's just these sort of legacy media companies have particular voices. And what I saw again and again was that the most interesting things that I was filing would end up on the cutting room floor, right? And sometimes it'd be details, say, about a death squad. Sometimes it'd be details about something else. But the stuff that I was most interested in never actually made it into the magazine. And so I think, why is that? You know, and I think there's those sort of typical, you're writing for the sort of middle American audience, so they don't want to take too many risks one way or the other. I think that's part of it. But I also think that there's a certain level of truth that you can kind of convey through the sort of that kind of magazine, and you have to go elsewhere if you really want to get close to the bone, at least for my opinion.
So do you remember anything that stood out to you, like where you wrote something, you're like, oh, this is really good, but it's, you know, I wonder if it'll push their buttons, and then it turned out it didn't get picked up?
Oh, yeah, here's a more kind of clear-cut example of that. Had I done that, so I did a big story about General Stanley McChrystal for Rolling Stone. That story would not have made it into Newsweek the way.
Wow. Okay. That so would that's not have made okay. It into Newsweek. Now we're having a conversation.
They would have taken all my good stuff and they would have buried it in the story. It would not have.
So talk to me about that, because so, like, if you guys don't know, you know, obviously Michael, huge story about Michael, about General McChrystal, And eventually, General McChrystal stepped down because of the revelations in Michael's story. And that's old school journalism. He was there, he documented it, etc. And I remember when it came out, I praise you to high heaven, not knowing you at all, because I was like, this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to cover them and then reveal to people what your government is doing, etc., etc. So it had real impact. Now, a story like that, Newsweek in the old days, you would have think would have loved, right?
Right, right. Depending on... I'll do a caveat. The Newsweek, as when John Meacham was editor, they would not have printed my story. I can guarantee you that.
Why do you think that is?
Political reasons, for reasons that there's a sense that at Newsweek we were supposed to kind of uphold, that we're supposed to sort of reinforce our societal myths, not deconstruct them and not kind of expose them. And so there was a real mission there. I think certainly under Meacham sucks. He's on my enemies list. One of the people I wanted to go on a rant on at some point this week. Where they were not going to push the button. You know, like senior military officials, despite how they've lied to us for a number of wars, despite the Pentagon Papers, despite all we knew from that kind of Newsweek mainstream perspective, we're going to be on this pedestal, and we would not have criticized them in that way. And I know this for a fact, because you can actually go back and read Newsweek's profile of McChrystal, which was done by a really great reporter, a guy named, I don't want to get him in trouble, but they took this great reporter's stuff and then they buried it, you know. And so one of the reasons I actually knew that, you know, there would be kind of an interesting story here, was because when I read this original Newsweek story a year before my story came out, and I was like, wow, like there's, like the reporter is trying to tell the truth here and his editors are killing it.
And thanks to Aaron Schwartz, they cannot kill us. You know why? Because we've got RSS feed.
Yep. Or TwitWit Radio.
I'm not losing my mind. I'm giving it away. You are listening to Pacifica Community Radio.
And let me jump around here.
State is here to stay, pretending not to be NATO.
Senator Black, I want you, thank you know so much. How do you think we could stop the war in Syria? And I'll tell you, here it is so simple. When the Russians went in, that war would have ended within a year, were it not for the fact that we rushed tow anti-tank missiles and MANPAD anti-aircraft missiles, and we got them. You know, we send them to the so-called moderate rebels, who are just the most venomous criminal people you have ever met in your life. And we know that it's like pouring a gallon of water in one end of a bathtub. It doesn't just sit up there, it spreads.
Yes.
And there's a market in these things. And what type of anti-tank missiles are used by ISIS and Al-Qaeda? American, made in the USA. If we had not rushed emergency supplies of anti-tank and anti-air missiles to the terrorists, the war would be over, peace would be at hand, rebuilding would be taking place, refugees would be pouring back from all over the world.
Yeah.
But it was the United States, through that specific action of the Central Intelligence Agency,
yes,
that managed to keep the terrorist armies alive. And make no mistake, we're fighting two of the progeny of Al-Qaeda, the group that slaughtered 3,000 Americans in Twin Towers on 9/11. One of them
is everybody that believes that bullshit. How could an Arab give the Pentagon air defense a holiday? You know. Well, I'm sure there are Secretary of State, Chief of Staffs who know who may or may not be Arab, but know a lot about that. Anyway, just using that to get the hell out of Senator Black's page on back to
43.
TwitWit, Aaron Schwartz, because the RSS feed we use to give you my
60 points. Give a misleading answer to this question. Who's watching the watchers? Who's watching?
Would you repeat the question?
Who's watching the watchers?
Flip the beam.
have a winner. Dub Dude is on the scoreboard.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm talking with the bully of Boston, Carmen Ortiz, U.S. District Attorney charged with murder of Aaron Schwartz. Are you going to cop a plea?
It is a felony to share information over the internet without permission of the owners. My office protects intellectual property from criminals. Aaron Schwartz was an unfortunate example.
I have a question for Ms. Ortiz.
I can't stay long.
Do you have any remorse?
Downloading scientific journals without paying the fee is a serious offense.
13 felony counts?
It sends a message.
Keep talking.
What message?
The internet is out of control.
That's why I like it, dude.
That kind of talk gives aid and comfort to Al-Qaeda.
What does Al-Qaeda want, Carmen?
Al-Qaeda wants America to pray on the floor.
It's Al-Qaeda, and it's always Al-Qaeda, always Al-Qaeda, always Al-Qaeda. It's Al-Qaeda when it happens to you.
Well, for a long time, what I would do is I had nothing on the web that said how old I was, and I wouldn't tell anyone, really. Until, you know, one day, there was a newspaper article about me winning the contest at MIT, and someone found it and, you know, replied back to the list, wow, he's 13, you know, according to this article. And that day, you know, it really sort of struck me that it wasn't really something I needed to hide from, that now that people really realized that I, you know, I could communicate, I didn't have to hide that fact anymore. The Cypherpunks was one of the first lists I joined. I was interested in that sort of encryption and that sort of thing a while back, and I joined the Cypherpunks, and I was 13 or only 14 now. By then, you know, the excitement had sort of gone out of it. All the interesting stuff had been done already. And then after that comes, you know, my own work, my project Blog Space, which allows people to build websites, and, you know, the other projects I'm working on right now, writing my articles about unschooling and about educational philosophy, which is to say that anyone can say whatever they want on any machine. And there's no real central control that has all the knowledge in it. It can pretend to. It can get a really close approximation. But I don't think it's ever possible to get all the way there. The voice is philosopher Aaron Schwartz. I'm Berkeley Kaden. This is Twitwit Radio. We are talking with U.S. District Attorney Carmen Ortiz, known as the Bully of Boston, now charged with the murder of Aaron Schwartz.
My client is pleading not guilty.
I wasn't anywhere near the crime scene.
Murder!
The case was delegated to my assistant. I didn't do it.
He uncovered classified documents.
Have you ever leaked a classified document to mislead the public?
An unauthorized leak? Never.
On whose orders?
No comment.
And you?
Leadership and likability profiles can detect criminal activity before it's too late.
A kill list?
I don't call it a kill list.
Ms. Ortiz was doing her job.
It wasn't my call. I wanted to drop the case.
Why is this always happening then, huh? Is it happening now?
No. Now I'm running for the Senate.
If predictive analysis can tell us who our enemies are going to be, shouldn't you be stopped right now?
You don't want to wait too long.
Are you on their side now?
He was on his way to being a national folk hero.
What did he do?
He murdered Sopa in the crib.
Well, why don't you prosecute the banks then?
Goldman Sachs is too big to prosecute. This tea has a bitter taste.
Oh, what is in this tea?
Now, tell us everything you know.
Do I have to tickle your feet?
No, please don't do that. No, go. No, look, I'll tell you, okay?
I'm your worst enemy. I'll break you, dude.
No, stop it. Stop it. I will tell you. Don't tickle my feet.
Hey, Dub Dude.
Welcome to a world where dreams only live in your sleep. Thank you.
was one day the shift crystallized. I think it was the day of the hearings on SOPA in the House. The day we got that phrase, it's no longer okay not to understand how the internet works. There was just something about watching those clueless members of Congress debate the bill, watching them insist they could regulate the internet and a bunch of nerds couldn't possibly stop them. That really brought it home for people that this was happening. The Congress was going to break the internet, and it just didn't care. I remember when this moment first hit me. I was at an event, and I was talking, and I got introduced to a U.S. senator. And I asked him why, despite being such a progressive, despite giving a speech in favor of civil liberties, why he was supporting a bill that would censor the internet. And, you know, that typical politician smile he had suddenly faded from his face, and his eyes started burning this fiery red. And he started shouting at me. So those people on the internet, they think they can get away with anything. They think they can just put anything up there, and there's nothing we can do to stop them. They put up everything. They put up our nuclear missiles, and they just laugh at us. Well, we're going to show them. There's got to be laws on the internet. It's got to be under control. Now, as far as I know, nobody has ever put up the U.S.'s nuclear missiles on the internet. But that's sort of the point. He wasn't having a rational concern. Right? It was this irrational fear that things were out of control. Here was this man, a United States senator, and those people on the internet, they were just mocking him. They had to be brought under control. Things had to be under control. And I think that was the attitude of Congress. And just to seeing that fire in that senator's eyes scared me, I think those hearings scared a lot of people. They saw this wasn't the attitude of a thoughtful government trying to resolve trade-offs in order to best represent its citizens. This was more like the attitude of a tyrant, so the citizens fought back. So Wikipedia went black, Reddit went black, Craigslist went black, the phone lines on Capitol Hill flat out melted. Members of Congress started rushing to issue statements retracting their support for the bill that they were promoting just a couple days ago. Former Senator Chris Dodd, now the chief lobbyist for Hollywood, he admitted after he lost that he had masterminded the whole evil plan. And he told the New York Times he'd never seen anything like it during his many years in Congress. And that was when hard it was for me to believe, after all this, we had won. The thing that everyone said was impossible, that some of the biggest companies in the world had written off as kind of a pipe dream, we did it.
And if you have editors who are willing to kind of let that stuff free, let it go, then maybe there could be something there.
You know, that's really, really interesting, because I wrote an article, I don't remember how many years ago now, on Huffington Post, saying fire, that was the headline was fire the editors. Because I said, look, I'm reading these amazing stories, but I'm reading them on A27.
This is Saint Uyghur.
Of course, I immediately knew this, and I'm saying it had nothing to do with 9/11, because if you read the whole paper, you knew that. They would tell you, right? It's not like, but they buried it. That wasn't the headlines. That wasn't, and when you go on TV, it's even worse, right? So I felt like the problem wasn't the reporters. You know, the problem was the editors who were making these decisions on what to highlight, what to bury. Now, I wrote that God knows how many years ago, but it turns out, I mean, there you were in the trenches, and that's exactly the experience that you had.
Exactly. And you could see, and the pressure, I mean, certainly not for the Iraq War. I mean, you would sit around the editorial room, and you could see people whose entire careers you think would have been opposed to something like that, like flipping like light switches, stepping in line to kind of support these policies. Mm-hmm. Exactly as you're saying. I mean, it's so difficult to kind of try to get the real news kind of into the paper, into the magazine. I mean, the New York Times, it has a couple people who do it and do a great job. The Washington Post have a couple people who do a great job. But the editors make it difficult.
I think it's safe to say that those are not
doubly
the words
and triply confirmed by people like Richard Clark, you know, former National Security Advisor, coming out and saying that in the wake of the Hastings crash, which was pretty remarkable at the time. But there you go. So this is, as you say, just confirmation of what we know. And just as a little tag on to that operator's story that you got there with the Brad Pitt Hollywoodization, big hat tip to Scott Horden on Twitter, who provided screenshots of the part in The Operators where McChrystal's SAS guy threatens to kill Michael Hastings. So that little tidbit's in the book as well, just for people who haven't seen it, and I'll put the link in the show notes so that you can see, read through that passage in The Operators.
But I think the bigger point here is obviously Vault 7 in general and what this is about. And I think confirmation might be one way of looking at this, because it's not just Hastings. It's, oh, by the way, your smart TV is watching you, and a lot of other things that have been talked about in the independent media that, again, made us conspiracy theory kooks. I think we are moving into the era of... we are all conspiracy theorists now. I think that slur really is going... has lost its power? Is losing its power? Who on earth with a straight face can say, oh, that's crazy conspiracy talk, when you talk about these types of machinations of the intelligence agencies at this point? They're openly talking about the deep state on the nightly news now. They're openly talking about the CIA, and they can hack into everything and watching you through your television. I mean, it is total... inversion of everything that people believed to be true 5 or 10 years ago. And of course, a lot of people are just going to go through the cognitive dissonance
who is
thing
guarding where they go, well, of all course, of their of statements very closely and no, is very concerned deal. About how that will play inside the Beltway. This is definitely a mainstream reporter who strayed off the reservation and kicked back against the system that had fed him so well up till that point. And certainly, I think we can see that Michael Hastings was the real deal, but if we can't see it from his own statements or from some of the just reading about his journalistic career, why don't we take a look at some of the increasingly incendiary interviews that he was giving in even mainstream outlets on such things as the downfall of General David Petraeus and other matters that were really starting to rattle some chains inside the Beltway.
I think there is a distinct lack of skepticism. I think when you have an institution like the Pentagon, every general since 2001 has said we are either winning or have won in Afghanistan, except for one moment when General McChrystal decided in 2009 to say, oh, actually, we're not winning. And the only reason he said that was because he wanted more troops, right? But immediately after he said that, then everyone else, then Petraeus and every other general that's followed him said, we're winning, we're winning, we're winning, when it's clear that's not the case. So... one has to say, why are we giving the Pentagon so much credibility to make these statements? Why hasn't the Pentagon press corps stood up and said, or some a member of it, and say, you've said in 2002, 2003, 2004 that we've won this war. You've said in 2006, 2007, 2008 that we've won this war. Why are you now saying we have to fight there for 10 more years? And that is literally what General McChrystal just said.
I think you lay it out, though, pretty well in your book. And here we have a little passage that I'm going to write. And this is where you're talking about this media, military, industrial complex. And the same, you know, idea that we think about Washington and Wall Street being too close. Everyone is too close to power, and they're too scared. And so this was the reaction that you were getting from people after the original Rolling Stone piece came out, after you basically got a general fired. And what happened, it says, it demonstrated just how tenuous one's position could be. Careers could flame out overnight. The political media class saw the story as a threat to their schmoozy, relationship, their very existence and social life. If you can't get wasted with a journalist who's writing a profile of you and piss all over the president who appointed you, what's the world coming to?
Yeah, that didn't make me too many friends in the in the Washington, D.C. press
corps. Were you shocked by that response that you wrote what was an honest account? You didn't try to protect McChrystal or the aides that surrounded him, and then you got really crazy backlash.
I was shocked that I was shocked that President Obama fired him. I think that was very significant. I did not realize how bad the relationship between the president and the Pentagon had been. And I think what that meant was this was President Obama reasserting his control over the Pentagon. So. Yeah, I was shocked on that front. I was also surprised by the media's response. And it was a portion of the media, the Pentagon media, the national security media. And at first I was sort of confused about it. And I was like, well, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. They don't really mean what they're saying about the story. But then as months and months went on, I'd get along fine with different government officials for the most part. But there was still this really intense, you know, hatred among a few of my colleagues. And I think in the sort of insight I had, or what I kind of realized, was that the Pentagon press corps is just that. They're the press corps for the Pentagon. And I know that sounds overstated.
Well, they serve the Pentagon, and they're scared to hurt the feelings, you could say, or step on the toes of the Pentagon.
Right. Look, you know, there was a Pentagon spokesperson, a guy by the name of Jeff Morrell. And now you knew Jeff Morrell was telling the truth because he'd start to sweat, because he'd be lying all the other time. And I listened to a radio show, and it's like Jeff Morrell and reporter from X mainstream publication, and I'm not going to mention, and they sound the same, you know, and they're complimenting each other and saying what great jobs they're both doing.
Michael Hastings, in your BuzzFeed article, The Sins of General David Petraeus, you argue that Petraeus was a master of deception. Do you think he should have resigned?
I mean, I think there's many other reasons Petraeus should have resigned besides who he's sleeping with that's not his wife. But I just want to make a point here. The larger point that I've been making is that essentially the media has played a role in protecting David Petraeus and promoting David Petraeus and mythologizing David Petraeus. And we saw it here tonight. General Kimmett, who was a spokesperson in Baghdad, who was a roommate of Petraeus, who was involved in one of the biggest debacles in recent foreign policy history, is on TV, you know, defending David Petraeus without actually addressing the real problems with David Petraeus' record. And those are the fact that he manipulated the White House into escalating into Afghanistan. He ran a campaign in Iraq that was brutally savage, included arming the worst of the worst, Shiite death squads, Sunni militiamen, and then you go back to the training of the Iraqi army program that also had similar problems. So for me, all the while he's going around the country talking about honor and integrity. So for me, the questions of honor and integrity, I was raising those earlier. A number of other journalists who were actually covering David Petraeus were raising those concerns. You might not get that from someone like Barbara Starr at CNN, who is essentially a spokesperson for the Pentagon in many ways. So I think I just want to step back and to have my piece, because I just, even the way the scandal is being covered is so different than how usual sex scandals are being covered, where they hammer the guy mercilessly. Now everyone's saying, oh my God, he was at, you know, he just went to the CIA. How could he be, you know, he was susceptible to being seduced by this woman. You know, give me a break. Petraeus now has all his allies coming out to defend him, where Paula Broadwell is there. Yet again, you know, where are her protectors?
Okay, well, but Barbara's not a spokesperson for him, obviously.
Is the cue to segue from Michael Hastings to some appropriate theme songs. So, excuse me while I bump around in this one. DJ Mouse found appropriate theme song for Michael Hastings and Aaron Schwartz. Get between the war machine and the corporate bank. Thank you.
silence howling, catches angels as they fall. And the all-time winner has got him by the balls. Oh, it picks up Gideon's Bible, open at page one. I thank God it stole the hammer and the pain, and won't stop. Oh, I know it could slow down.
They could think of to do. They didn't stop to ask anyone for permission. The senators were right. The internet really is out of control. But if we forget that, if we let Hollywood rewrite the story so it was just big company Google who stopped the bill, if we let them persuade us we didn't actually make a difference, and we start seeing it as someone else's responsibility to do this work, well, then next time, they might just win. Let's not let that happen.
Oh. Maybe he meant having Brad Pitt play the evil shithook. I mean, don't you make Brad Pitt play the good guy? You know, play Hastings? No, this is Hollywood. Yo, here's Michael Hastings.
But let's move to the Lieutenant Colonel.
Not too obviously. I've followed her coverage pretty closely, as she's covered my work before, too.
Well, just because she's written naughty things about you, it doesn't make her a spokesperson.
No, what makes her a spokesperson is repeating, without question, a lot of Pentagon claims.
I never saw George W. Bush give a speech where he conceded that, you know, these decisions aren't that simple.
He had better speechwriters at this time. I don't know what happened to the first term speechwriters, but certainly they weren't working on this speech. I mean, this speech, in my view, if you compare this speech to his the speech he gave in Cairo in 2009 or his Nobel Prize speech, you see a kind of almost total rejection of the civil rights tradition that President Obama supposedly came out of, a total rejection of any kind of these ideas of a kind of peaceful transition, of a kind of trying to work with the fellow people in different nations, and just an embrace of total militarism. And the reason I say this is because that speech to me was essentially agreeing with President Bush and Vice President Cheney that we're at, in this sort of neoconservative paradigm, that we're at war with a jihadist threat that actually is not a nuisance, but the most important threat we are facing today. It is a complete, in my view, a complete rejection of what John Kerry said, and I said, an embrace of militarism.
He says
that many multiple things.
I agree, it's complex, but I mean,
complex, but he enshrines, look, the two key things that I took away from that speech is that Obama has enshrined the two most radical principles of the Bush doctrine. The first is, he got rid of torture and sort of got rid of extraordinary rendition, but enshrines targeted assassination. At the same time, he won't apologize for the scandal in Benghazi. He won't apologize for the IRS, a few bad apples. And he says, no, the AP and spying on journalists is okay. So he enshrines killing people and spying on journalists as the two major tenets of his national security state. I think this is outrageous.
And Benghazi, September 11, 2012, was the day Bradley Birkenfeld, the Lucifer's banker author, got that $100 million to stop talking about the death squad assassination campaign contra war behind the Arab sting. See you next Tuesday at noon, kids.